Since July 1973, the United States has had a volunteer army. My guest, George Wilson, has studied the new volunteer army from the inside to see who is joining and if the soldiers and officers have the willingness, skill, and leadership to hold in a war. For 1 year, he lived off and on with new professional soldiers, following them from basic training at Fort Benning, Georgia, to Fort Riley's Charlie Company. Wilson's new book is called Mud Soldiers. He says that's a term of affectionate respect for the infantrymen who have it hardest and die soonest in most of our wars. Wilson is the chief defense correspondent for the Washington Post and author of the books The Army in Anguish and Super Carrier, for which he spent 7 months living inside the steel walls of an aircraft carrier. He wrote Mud Soldiers after Army generals told him that no one was writing about the new volunteer army.
I couldn't do the whole army, of course, but I thought the spear point of it, the rifle companies that go first, die first, have to be ready, would be the most meaningful assessment as to how we stand now in this experiment that we've been conducting since 1973 of eliminating the draft and going for an all-volunteer army.
When America switched to a volunteer army, one of the fears was that the army would be comprised of the uneducated and the poor. So I'm wondering if that's actually happened, and you know, who are, from what you've seen, who are the new volunteers, and what are their motivations for joining the Army?
Well, most of them are the have-nots of our society. They're the non-establishment teenagers who don't have the easy access to a job with their father's company or money in a bank for college. But they're not the uneducated, because more than 90% of today's Army has his high school diploma. And they score pretty high on the tests, the ones that they're accepting, the so-called Category 1s and Category 2s. But having said all that, they very often come from broken homes, and the Army, in some cases, is their first home. And they're joining because they've looked around at their options at their hometowns, and they said, look, I don't want to work at the local plywood factory or flip hamburgers at McDonald's. The Army sounds like it'd be kind of fun, and it looks like a step up for me.
Are today's young men in the Army less fit on the whole than they were when there was a draft? In other words, does the Army have to take who it can get and make accommodations?
Well, I was in Vietnam in 68 and 72, and I spent a fair amount of time with rifle units. And I have to say that I was not worried about the troops holding and dying for their country then, and I'm not worried about the troops holding and dying for their country today. The soldiers are much more on top of what they're supposed to learn as soldiers than is the middle management, the sergeants and young officers. We've gotten back to this ticket-punching system where the officers don't stay in their job long enough to get good at it. It's kind of like a quarterback who does spring practice, goes to the Super Bowl, and then he's on to another profession. A guy only has a rifle company for a year, year and a half, and then he goes on to punch his ticket by going to a war college. And out in the desert, I saw us lose battle after battle, and it was not the troops' fault, not the volunteer soldiers' fault. It was the officers, basically, didn't know what they were doing. Again, through no fault of the officers, it's just a system that doesn't let them stay in command long enough to master the intricacies. And I tell you, running a rifle company in high-speed warfare of today takes a lot of practice, and we're not giving it to these middle management sergeants and officers. We used to leave guys with their rifle units and platoons for 3 years. We've gotten away from that. Now everybody's supposed to be a Renaissance man, and the kids are paying the price because they're having officers that don't know their skills.
Let's get back to the troops. There was also a fear that there wouldn't be enough volunteers to fill the Army. You say the tide turned in the 1980s.
That's right.
What changed in the 1980s?
Well, a lot of things happened at once. First of all, the pay got better. The GI Bill got restored so that if you signed up tomorrow morning for 4 years in the Army, you'd have $25,000 roughly when you got out. And I have to say that there was the poison in the well that we had in Vietnam disappeared. And Ronald Reagan, if he did nothing else, reasserted this kind of patriotism, the sense of pride in the military. And things turned around, plus just time. I mean, you have to remember that the Tet Offensive in Vietnam was 1968. That was before most of today's soldiers were born. And the hero drill instructor, if you believe it or not, at Fort Benning, when I went through with these young volunteers, was a rifle leader from the Grenada, which, you know, to you and me is probably just a minor little operation, but to a guy 18, 19, that was his war.
Would you explain what the financial benefits are and other benefits that accrue to soldiers who volunteer for the Army?
All right, if you join a combat arm tomorrow morning, in other words, infantry or artillery or some of those specialties which do the actual fighting as opposed to working in a hospital or a computer center, you would as a private, you'd get about $650 a month for starting pay. But more importantly, if you finished your training successfully, you'd get your $5,000 bonus for signing up for a combat arm. And if you joined the put-away program for your college, you'd get $25,000 roughly at the end of 4 years in a kind of updated GI Bill to put towards college. And there's other college benefits, but those are the main ones. And when young men look around and see their options, they think that this is a better deal than they can get around home in many cases, plus the fact that there's security. You know, the jobs are there. You don't get laid off as an infantry rifleman. So in many communities of this country, that's a better future than one can get in the private sector. And then also you've got something on your resume to show an employer that, look, I did 4 years in the Army and I was here, there, and the other place. And most of the guys I talked to after 1 year said that the biggest benefit was not so much the skills in the sense of translating them to the civilian sector, but it made them kind of grow up and see a lot of the country and learn about different people than they would have if they'd stayed home and been more comfortable.
I see all the Be All You Can Be campaign commercials on television. How effective have they been?
They've been effective. The problem is that it sets them up for disillusionment. The young men and women do join thinking that this really is an opportunity to be all you can be. And they keep that motivation through basic training and advanced individual training, which is roughly a 4-month process. Then they report to their unit, and it's kind of business as usual. And too often the officers and sergeants treat them as draftees with no rights and kind of waste their time. And it's a big letdown. And they're wondering, gee, I can't be all I can be. So some of them hang in there and, go through the motions of being a soldier. But I have to tell you that a lot of air comes out of the balloon because we're not imagined enough to keep up this motivation. I mean, these guys joined because they thought they were getting somewhere. And if you fail to show the light at the end of their tunnel, they just give up on themselves and the Army and everything else. And it's tough in peacetime. We have no enemy at the gate. We have no war to get ready for. So how do you keep it interesting out there in the plains of Fort Riley? Well, my answer is, how do you keep teaching your algebra and geometry to high school students interesting? You have to be a good leader. You have to be imaginative. But we're falling down badly on that.
What about soldiers with wives and children? And there really are a lot of married soldiers now in the volunteer Army. How do the families do? How do the wives feel about the way they're treated?
Well, we really are going through a social revolution in all the military services. First of all, you have women in uniform. You have more married soldiers than you ever did before. They don't live in open bay barracks like they used to. They live in individual rooms like a dormitory. And so the women that I got to know the best in following this rifle company for a year were wives of very junior enlisted people, you know, privates, private first class. And they were really up against it economically, and their husbands were in the field all the time. So living in a trailer in Junction City, Kansas, and having a little baby and not seeing your husband except for weekends, if that, and kind of scraping to get by wasn't exactly glamorous. And when they go to Germany, the living isn't too easy either. Now, in fairness to the Army, they warn these young soldiers that, look, living off the economy is going to be tough, but, you know, human beings are human beings, and they like to bring their wives with them. But it's a tough struggle for the enlisted man's wives until their husbands get some rank, you know, like sergeant and above.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the drill instructors during basic training. Are they still, for the most part, in the style of, say, Lou Gossett in Officer and a Gentleman?
Well, there's a lot of that on the surface, but I have to tell you that I had covered some Marine abuse trials, Bubba McClure, who was beaten to death and while his drill sergeant looked on, and I was familiar with Sergeant McCune, who marched his troops into Ribbon Creek and Paris Island and drowned some of them. So I came in there thinking that these guys were really bullies, But I have to say that after watching them day after day, week after week at Fort Benning, the drill instructors are pretty sensitive to the needs of these guys, and they're not by any means coddling them. But the one thing that drill instructors can do that most adults could not do while these guys were growing up was they can perform the missions that they are asking their troops to do. And it's very impressive for a drill instructor to do all the exercises, run with the guys for 3 miles, stay with them from dawn till dark. I mean, these guys work 16 hours a day and 7 days a week, certainly 6 days. And so I asked each of these troopers, after they'd finished basic training, what they thought of the drill instructors. If they had it to do over again, would they go through this agony of, you know, being terrorized in the beginning and then being very firmly controlled later? And most of them were very fond of the drill instructors and thought they had done them an awful lot of good. Now, having said that, and saying that the drill instructors most of the time are heroes to their charges, there are some guys who can't handle that kind of discipline. And we had 4 attempted suicides in this company of 200 trainees that I watched very closely. None of the suicide attempts was successful, but a guy who is a loner in high school, can't relate to his peers, and can't take orders, and can't adjust, you know, the Army's not for him.
Since, you mentioned this example of 4 suicides, do you think that there should be a way out for volunteers if after, as soon as a few weeks or a couple of months, they decide they made the really wrong choice?
Well, that's one of my strongest recommendations in the book, is that we provide exit options for people who enlist. But again, the suicide attempts are referred to professional counselors, and of those 4 attempts, 3 of the 4 were indeed discharged from the Army. So it's not as though they're insensitive to it once it occurs, but it's always a fine line for the poor old drill instructor who's got a million things to worry about. Is this guy faking, or is he really mean it? And everybody threatens to jump out windows. Are these guys really going to do it? And you're asking the drill instructor to be a doctor, a psychiatrist, a chaplain. But at any rate, they do have a way to get rid of misfits. But my point is that if I'm a 17-year-old and I signed up for the Army Infantry for 4 years, I probably didn't really know what it was going to be like. I didn't know what I was doing. And I think there should be an exit window at, say, the halfway mark of my 4-year enlistment, so that if I really don't like this man's Army, I'll put in my 2 years, I've done the country some good, I'm trained as an apprentice infantryman, but I don't have to go through misery if that's what it's become. And we offer that option to West Point cadets with no penalty. So I say, why not give it to the grunts and save all this legal business of chaptering misfits out? I mean, guys at Fort Riley who just couldn't hack the Army any longer after graduating from Fort Benning resorted to such things as jumping out windows, going back on drugs just to get themselves kicked out. I say, let's save all that pain. Anybody who doesn't want to be in there isn't really doing the outfit much good.
You were telling us a little earlier that you really had a higher regard for the soldiers than for the officers. And I'm going to ask you now to elaborate on that, to elaborate on the shortcomings in the officers and in the system that creates officers in the volunteer Army.
Well, it's not in terms of personal regard. I have high regard for both the officers and the enlisted soldiers. My point, however, is that we don't allow our officers to get good at their trade. In other words, for me to be a really good platoon leader or a really good company commander and know how to deploy aircraft, how to defend against tanks, how to use missiles that are behind me, how to get my troops so that they don't go running up against a wood line and get themselves killed, takes a lot of practice, a lot of skills, a lot of time at this intricate ballet, which is a rifle company in action.
You suggest that officers go back through basic training with soldiers.
Right. I also don't like the fact that there doesn't seem to be any recognition in the middle management that these guys really did believe that they joined the Army to be all they can be, and they do have dreams, and they're not just draftees who are marking their time, and all they care about is 3 hots and a cot, as I used to say. They really have some ambitions. But the only way I can figure out to convince these officers that they're dealing with a different breed of soldier is to immerse them in the stress environment of basic training. Also, frankly, the officers would learn a lot about the basic skills of running through woods and taking on ambushers. So my proposal is, okay, after you've gotten your commission as a green second lieutenant, from either West Point or an ROTC college, go down there at Fort Benning or wherever and go through basic training for 7 weeks with the troops. No favors, no bars on your shoulders. And you'll know after hours by talking to your fellow soldiers what they're about, why they're in the Army, what they expect of you. And then you can reestablish the fire break after that 7 weeks. I don't think it would kill anybody. It would be immensely helpful in letting these officers know what kind of soldiers they're going to be commanding.
Let's look at some of the weapons in the Army today. One of the ones you talk about you think is a disgrace. It's called the Dragon, and you think it's a disgrace that foot soldiers should have to lug this thing around. Would you describe it and why you don't like it?
Right. Well, first of all, it's a missile that you fire out of a long tube, and to fire it, you've got to sit underneath it. It's kind of on your lap, and then there's a little tripod out there. But what really enrages me about the Dragon is, and I was there as the sergeants were instructing the troops how to use it, is that they say, look, you've got to keep the crosshairs on the oncoming tank twice as long as it takes the tank to find and kill you. And you can't move and duck in a hole after you pull the trigger. You just got to sit there out there in the open field, because if you try and get down the foxhole, the wire that trails out behind the missile will get tangled, or it'll hit a lake and short circuit. So you got to, in effect, sit out there and risk suicide.
In terms of defense, we've spent so much money in the past few years on the big high-tech items, nuclear missiles, nuclear silos, super carriers. Do you think that a disproportionate amount of money is going to the super high-tech stuff and perhaps not enough to the troops and to the weapons that the troops would use?
Right. I think the infantryman has gotten low priority. I mean, what do we use when we try to make a point? We don't use the stealth bomber, and we can't use the missiles. We send good old-fashioned troops down to Panama. We send good old-fashioned troops to Grenada. We send troops in to try and rescue American hostages. Sure, we need a given number of high-tech weapons to build deterrents. If you fired us, we can do worse to you, kind of a deterrent posture. But it seems to me that this country should make sure that the troops that are most likely to go to war first, be the point of the spear, ought to be the best equipped. I mean, the radio's still cut out all the time. I mean, we were in the desert at night, and there was always problems with the radios. I don't know whether it's doomed to be ever so, but it just seems to me we ought to at least have a reliable radio to start with.
Are you concerned about whether there's enough money in the defense budget now for the volunteer army to pay the troops?
Well, no, I don't. That's not my big fear. My fear is more the priority, how we divide up the money pie. I mean, like it or not, right or wrong, we are restructuring the American military today by subtraction after years of addition. And if Bush and Gorbachev can work it out, the Army's going to get smaller and smaller. Currently, it's half the size of the Vietnam Army. It's about 760,000 today. It was 1.5 million in 68 at the height of the Vietnam War. So if it's going to be smaller, and I have no problem with that, I think the idea is to bring peace to the world. If it's going to be smaller, it's got to be awfully good.
Let's look at some of your recommendations for the Army. You recommend, and this is interesting, that training should be more fun.
Yeah. These guys, I mean, who's going to join the infantry today? You know, you're cold, you're wet, you can make more money probably and go home at night and have a beer. It's a guy who wants some adventure, who wants to be a little bit of a Rambo, who thinks that, again, as we said earlier, that he's going to get somewhere, but he doesn't want to be bored to death doing it. But so often we just let these guys sit around out there in their units. And this isn't just in Fort Riley where I happen to focus. I've been getting letters from all over the country since the book came out of officers decrying the fact that the system doesn't allow them to be imaginative. And somehow we've gotten this workaholic syndrome of everybody's got to be out pretending they're training, even if there's nothing meaningful to do. I don't care if they work a half day and then swim and play basketball. That's part of being fit. And I think you've got to keep up the enthusiasm in the military. And standing out in the rain, having a sergeant read out of a field manual, which I saw for myself time after time, that's not the way to make it fun for guys who, join the infantry for some adventure.
I guess the bottom line question is, do you think that the volunteer army inspires confidence?
Well, I think it's a good army. I just think it could be a much better army. I mean, we're asking a lot of the Army to be at a fever pitch in peacetime, and it's a real challenge for the leadership. But I have to say that we should recognize that it's a thin red line, that it's a small army, that the draft is coming back as soon as we get, if we get, in any kind of a substantial conflict, even as small as Vietnam, because there's so few trigger pullers in the active duty army that they can go out and they'll hold, but then we've got to activate the reserves. The reserves are not going to be draft dodging haven anymore if we get in any kind of a major conflict. And then the draft has to get cranked up. And this seed corn army we've got out here has got to train the raw kids off the streets. So we've got to keep our training base hot, but we've also got to make sure that this volunteer army is small and, you know, help it be all it can be.
Well, George Wilson, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, enjoyed it.